what I want to do today is to share with you a little bit about an approach to values-driven behavior, values-driven leadership development called Giving Voice to Values that I've developed and that we've shared around the world. I'm not going to use slides. I'm basically going to just tell you some stories and talk to you a little bit about the research this is based on and why and how it works. Although this approach was developed originally for use in business education, I was a professor at Harvard Business School. I was there for 10 years. I was 6 years at Babson College in the US, which is number one in the world for entrepreneurship. And now I'm at the University of Virginia Darden School of Business. And I developed this approach for use in graduate business education. But much to my surprise, it has actually grown well beyond that. We developed this about a dozen years ago. It's now being used, it has been used on all 7 continents, including the Antarctic, believe it or not. Lockheed Martin brought it there. It's been used in businesses. It's been used in healthcare. It's being used in legal and engineering education. It's been used with the Australian Police Force, with the US military. And interestingly, most recently, we've worked with the financial sector, with investment advisors and professionals in particular. I've done work with investment advisors in the US, in London, in Hong Kong, in Singapore, and in Australia. So I'm delighted to share with you now. Basically, if you daze out while I'm talking, or your mind wanders, I hope it doesn't, this is what I hope you remember if you don't remember anything else of what I'm going to say this morning. I want you to remember that giving voice to values, or GVV, as I call it, is about asking and answering a new question, a different question when it comes to values in our professional lives and in our wider lives. So instead of asking the usual question, which is, what is the right thing to do in any particular situation? That's an important question. It's one I'm sure you end up talking about in the conversations about knowing yourself, knowing the markets, knowing your clients. But giving voice to values is about asking and answering the question, once you know what you believe the right thing to do is, your values, your ethics, how do you get it done? What do you need to say? To whom? In what sequence? What will the pushback be? What kinds of data do you need to gather? How do you need to frame the conversation? So anyways, that's what GVV is. If you remember nothing else, it's about asking and answering a different question. How do you get the right thing done? This work actually grew out of my own, what I call a crisis of faith. I had been working in business education at leading business schools, like I said, Harvard, Babson, Darden. I'd been working in those contexts and consulting to other leading business schools around the world, in Seattle and others. And I'd been working on the subject of values-driven leadership and business ethics. And a number of years ago, in the late 90s, I had this crisis of faith. And I began to feel that, you know, maybe trying to talk about values and ethics and professional behavior in business and in business education, maybe that was unethical. I began to feel that, you know, maybe at best it's futile and at worst it's hypocritical. And I felt that way for a lot of reasons, you know. It seemed that every few years there'd be a spate of major scandals that would hit the press. In the 70s, we had the defense industry scandals. In the 80s, we had the insider trading scandals. And more recently, we've had Enron and WorldCom and Parmalat and Galleon Group. And then even more recently, Wells Fargo and Volkswagen, et cetera, et cetera. And every time these scandals would hit the press, if you happened to be working in a leading business educational setting, as I was, we would create some kind of task force. And I was always on the task force because there'd be a lot of criticism of what are we doing in these educational settings to turn out leaders who end up on the front page of the business press as the architects of these scandals. And, you know, we would do a lot of research and we'd interview recruiters and graduates and faculty and alumni, and we would end up creating new courses and new research. And then a few years later, the whole cycle would start again. You know, there'd be another spate of scandals and we'd create another task force. And I had lived through this several times. And I began to feel that this was ridiculous. It wasn't really making any impact. The second reason for my crisis of faith was a little more personal. I had a friend who used to run the business ethics program at Stanford Business School. And he invited me to be part of a debate at the University of Santa Clara. And he was going to have two people on one side of the debate who would argue that after a quarter of a century of good faith efforts to try and raise the ethical behavior, values-driven behavior of business people through education. We've made a huge amount of progress. And he wanted two people on the other side to say we haven't made any progress. And on this side, the negative side, he had Milton Friedman's son, who's also an economist. And he asked me to be on the side of the debate saying we've made all this progress. So I sat down to write my remarks, and I had this moment where I thought, can I lie on an ethics panel? You know, because I wasn't really sure what I could say, honestly. So I ended up creating some kind of nuanced statement about how, you know, any of us who've been in a mentoring or educational context or even managing your employees, you know there's individuals you've had an impact on. But if I were going to speak more broadly, I really couldn't say we'd move the needle. So that was kind of a watershed moment. But the biggest reason for my crisis of faith is what I would see in rooms like this, whether they were classrooms or corporate training rooms or professional training programs. And it was this, that whenever we would talk about values or ethics in business, we would usually give people some thorny ethical dilemma, some case to read, and they'd walk into the room with an idea of what they thought the right thing to do was. And then in the course of the discussion, two things would happen. The first thing that would happen is that your thinking would become more complex. You'd realize that maybe you hadn't had all the information, or maybe this is really just the way it's done in this industry, or this part of the world, or this organization. Or maybe it is wrong, but, you know, if you try and do something, you're not likely to really move the needle, and you may make things worse, at least for yourself. So, you know, this would make people thinking more complex. I actually think that's a good thing, right? You don't want people to walk into these situations naively. But the second thing that would happen was more troubling to me. And it was this. I don't know if you've had this experience, but I'd go into these settings, and there were usually two or three people that when they spoke, everyone would turn to listen to them. You know, maybe they were the most articulate. Maybe they were the ones who always had a witty story to tell to illustrate their point. In the corporate settings, they were usually the people of the highest rank. But whatever it was, when those people spoke, the ones everyone listened to, they were usually the ones who were voicing the most skeptical, if not cynical, positions. They were the ones who were saying, you know, Mary, I know what you want me to say, but in the real world, it's just not possible, right? So I thought people were walking out of these sessions more confused and less empowered. And I thought, boy, is that really what I want to do with my life? You know, life is short. I want to do something that matters. I got skills. I'll do something else, right? So I took a step back from this work. And around that time, several things happened. I'm going to tell you just a couple stories which led to the creation of Giving Voice to Values. So the first thing that happened is I got a consulting gig at Columbia Business School. And I was working on something else. But while I was there, there were a group of about four or five senior faculty in finance, in economics, in accounting, in strategy, who were still working on these issues of values and ethics in business education. And they had decided to do something with their MBA students. This was their idea. They invited all of the incoming MBA students, it was about 600 at the time, upon matriculation, during orientation, to answer one question. Tell us about a time in your work experience when you were explicitly told or implicitly pressured to do something that conflicted with your own values and how you handled it. And they collected all these stories, just about a paragraph or two, no names, and they weren't quite sure what to do with them. So they said, Mary, would you take a look at these? So I read hundreds and hundreds of these over several years, well over 1,000, and they were really interesting. So let me tell you what we learned. If you think about the kinds of people who were getting an MBA education at a school like Columbia at the time, they already had, on average, 3 or 4, sometimes 5 years of work experience. So the first thing we learned is that I could probably count on one hand the number of them who said I was never asked to do something that I thought was wrong. They all pretty much had a story to tell. The second thing we learned is if you think about the kinds of people who get a degree at Columbia, certain industries are more heavily represented, very heavy in finance, and then a number of other industries. So because of that, the kinds of stories that they told got repetitious very quickly. So, for example, they talked about things like being pressured to tamper with or adjust the equations or the benchmarks they use to evaluate the relative attractiveness or lack of attractiveness of a particular financial transaction in order to encourage clients to take the action that would maximize revenue for their employers. And there were lots of other stories too, but those are ones that might be relevant to you. And then we also saw that their answers tended to fall into some recognizable buckets. So the largest bucket, the little less than half of them said, you know, yeah, I had this values conflict, and it bothered me. It didn't just roll off my back, but I didn't think I had any choices. So I just sucked it up and did what they told me to do. That was the largest group. A small group said, I tried to act. Because it really bothered me, or not that I tried to act, but I couldn't act, I couldn't do what they were telling me because it really bothered me, but they didn't think they had a choice either. So they removed themselves from the situation. They moved themselves to a different work group, or some of them even quit their jobs. But the remaining third of them said, yeah, I had this conflict, and I tried to act. And a small number of them said, I tried and failed. But about a quarter of the whole group said, I tried, and by my lights, I was successful. So we thought this was interesting. Why could some of these folks do this effectively when so many others couldn't? And, you know, they all had made it into Columbia Business School. They had some level of competence, right? They were talking about the same industries, the same types of values conflicts, and yet some were able to do it. So we took another look at these stories, and we sliced and diced them to look for patterns. You know, and in the end, we thought maybe there's something we'll figure out here. In the end, we really couldn't say that one group was more morally troubled than the other group. Or we couldn't say that one group was more organizationally savvy or politically sophisticated than the other group. In the end, the only thing we could say is that the people who were able to do this effectively at some point said something outside of their own heads. And it might have started by talking to a spouse or a partner or a friend, but eventually it found its way into their organizations and changed the trajectory of things. So when that happened, we thought, okay, you know, what do we do with this? I was looking for some kind of lever to pull or string to pull that was going to help us to figure out how to develop this capacity, this competence. And I was a little discouraged until I remembered some research that I had seen years earlier when I was still at Harvard. And it was two studies by two different scholars, Douglas Hanecke and Perry London, who both decided they were going to do research on people who act with great conviction in times of high risk, high stakes. And they both decided independently that they were going to talk to people who are often referred to as rescuers from World War II. So these are people who risked their own lives to help others who were in danger during the Holocaust. And they did in-depth interviews, it was qualitative research, and they looked up, tried to find patterns in their background, their education, their family lives, their beliefs. And they found a few characteristics, and I frankly don't remember most of them. But there was one that really resonated with me, probably because I was an educator. And they said the people who were able to effectively act on their values in these really high-stakes situations all reported that at an earlier point in their lives, usually with someone more senior to them, and usually as a young adult, they'd had the experience of voicing out loud the answer to the question, what if, and there was some sort of moral conflict, what would you do? And so they'd had the experience at both the cognitive level, actually naming the value that mattered to them, and creating a kind of script or articulation, and at the behavioral level, actually experiencing voicing that position out loud to someone more senior to them, a parent, a teacher, a boss, a mentor, who stood in as proxy for the kind of person they might need to speak to in the moment. So I thought this idea of pre-scripting, rehearsal, peer coaching was interesting. So we started to look at the research. And this was about 10 or 12 years ago. There was starting to be a lot of research in a lot of different disciplines that suggested that rehearsal and pre-scripting and peer coaching are very effective ways to build this kind of moral competence. So in the field of social psychology, you'll probably hear more about this over the next few days. There's research, you've probably read about some of the research on habit formation, for example. There's also a group of psychologists who study what's called positive deviance, people who deviate from the norm, but in a positive direction. And they have a great phrase. They say, if you want to have an impact on people's behavior, rather than asking them to think their way into a different way of acting, you should ask them to act their way into a different way of thinking. This supports this idea of rehearsal and prescripting. And there was research in the field of neurosciences, and you've probably seen some of the popularizations of this around creating new neural pathways and around brain plasticity. But the story I want to tell you comes from the field of kinesthetics, or the study of physical movement. And those of you who are athletes will be familiar with this. So back in the day when I still worked at Harvard Business School, I decided to take a self-defense class. Now, I had never in my life felt the need to take a self-defense class until I went to work at Harvard Business School. You know, I don't know. Make of that what you will. But I looked around Boston, and there were a lot of these classes, and one of them was different. Most of them just taught you the moves, you know, fist to bridge of nose, and heel to instep, and knee to groin, and you would practice them in the air. But this one was different. It was a developmental model. It was called model mugging. And they would teach you all of these moves, but then at a certain point, once you knew them, they'd bring in a guy in a padded suit, like the Michelin Man, and they'd line us all up, and we would take turns getting attacked, and then you could use these moves on him full force because he was protected. And in the beginning, it was kind of ludicrous because you just stood there waiting your turn to get attacked. But as the class went on, week after week, I'd be talking to you, he would come and grab me, I would never know when, I would never know what hold he was going to use. It was really nerve-wracking. But they explained to us, it was based on this research called specific state muscle memory, so that if you rehearse something in the same physiological and emotional and cognitive state that you'll be in when you need to use it, that even if you freeze in the moment, your body remembers. So one day, I'm lying on my back on the floor thinking about this, and I've failed to protect myself, and I thought, could we create a kind of moral muscle memory? Could we create a default to voice, but not just to speaking up, but a default to informed voice? Because one of the things I was learning from all of my research as I talked to many, many people and read all those Columbia stories about how people do this effectively is that there's a certain set of reasons or rationalizations, objections that you encounter that come up again and again when you try and voice your values. And they're very powerful, but they're not bulletproof. And so the idea is to actually rehearse, to prescript, to normalize that experience. Usually when we teach about values, we teach about awareness. You know, we ask you to become familiar with all the kinds of values conflicts you might encounter in your investment professional lives. We teach analysis, which is we familiarize yourself with all the guidelines and the regulations and the legal requirements and the principles so that you can reason through what's appropriate or not. But what we didn't do is teach the third A, or action, which is once you've figured it out, how do you influence the people you need to influence, whether it's your colleagues and boss who are pressuring you to behave in a way that you don't think is in the best interest of your client, or whether it's your client who's pressuring you to behave in a way that you think is inappropriate for them or for the markets. So in other words, we thought we need to develop a different pedagogy. So then we started looking at the research around people's ethical behavior. There's a lot of research now in behavioral ethics, behavioral economics, and some of the research suggests, this particular work by Jonathan Haidt started this, that in fact, that people will, when they confront a values conflict, we don't tend to sit down and reason through it in this logical way and think about ethics and laws and regulations and principles. We tend to react emotionally, as Graham mentioned, and then we rationalize post hoc why it was the only thing we could do or why it was even the right thing to do. And so if you teach people just about the reasoning part, you're not actually breaking that sort of built-in pattern, that muscle memory. So what we really needed to do was to create a technology for literally rewiring that automatic response. And so we created what we call the Giving Voice to Values thought experiment, which is we created scenarios, cases, but they end with a protagonist who knows what the right thing to do is. It's not the ethical debate. And the work is to figure out how could they be effective at acting on it? What could they say and do? What would the objections be? But I'm going to wrap up right now simply by saying that this simple shift from focusing on thinking about ethics as if it's entirely a cognitive problem, a black box that if you have a framework and decide what's right, you're done. Shifting from that to talking about values and ethics as being about how do I act on what I already believe and what I already know is the appropriate thing to do, and how can I do that effectively without having to be a martyr about it. That shift is very powerful, and it's actually very empowering, and we found that it was very attractive, not just to educators, but to practitioners, as I said. So I'll just conclude by saying that you've probably figured out giving voice to values is really just a reframe. Instead of asking what's right, we ask how do you get the right thing done? And it's based on three flips. We've flipped what it is we're talking about when we talk about values and ethics. We've flipped who we think we're talking to, and we've reflipped how we have the conversation. So in terms of what it is we're talking about, it used to be if someone asked me what I did for a living, I would lie. I lie a lot for an ethics person. because if I told them I worked on business ethics or values in business, they would usually make a lot of bad jokes about how it's an oxymoron and, you know, sort of tiresome. But if I actually told them what I did, eventually someone would say, you know, Mary, if you really care about that stuff, you should focus on the gray issues. The black and white clear-cut issues are easy. And I used to think that was the right way to go, but I've actually changed my mind. If you focus on the gray issues, you will never get past the analysis, the conversation about how many angels dance on the head of a pin. But if you actually focus on issues where most of us, not everybody, but most of us would agree, that's clearly over the line. It's clearly illegal or fraudulent. Even if not everyone acts on that, at some level they would agree. Then you can get to the conversation about action. So we shifted the kinds of issues we focus on. And then we shifted how we think about who we're talking to. Instead of, you know, I used to walk into a company or a schoolroom or an organization and they'd say, you know, most of the people here are good people. We've just got a few bad apples. They're the ones this training is for. I actually think of the audience differently. I think of the audience as a bell curve. And this is based on some research by the late Greg Dees and Peter Crampton. So this bell curve, we premise that at one end of the bell curve are people who self-identify as opportunists. And we define opportunists as people who would say, I'll do whatever it takes to maximize my material self-interest. Values be damned, right? Now, nobody falls into one of these categories all the time, but these are people who will say that's their primary motivation. And at the other tail end of the bell curve are the folks who would say, we call them idealists, who would say, I will always try and act on my values, regardless of the impact on my self-interest. What we premise is that the majority of us fall under the bell, and we call them pragmatists. I put myself there. And we define pragmatists as people who say, I would like to act on my values, as long as it doesn't put me at a systematic disadvantage. Now, that's not the same as saying, as long as I know I'll succeed. It's not the same as saying, as long as I know I'll never pay a price. It simply means, I think I have a shot. And if you think of your audience that way, I don't think I have the power to change the opportunists. I think they'll always be with us. And I'm not so worried about the idealists, except I would like them to be more skillful, more competent. But we're really focusing on the pragmatists, and we're saying we want to give you the skills, we want to give you the literal scripts and the rehearsal, the practice to create that moral muscle memory and the positive examples to be who you already want to be at your best. So we're not trying to change you, we're trying to empower you. And then the final flip is how we do all this, and I already explained that to you. Instead of focusing on, you know, the ethical and values analysis, instead of asking what is the right thing to do, we focus on once you know what's right, how do you get it done effectively? And we've also have focused a lot on helping people understand how there's many ways to get to that answer, and a lot of them have to do with understanding your own particular strengths and skills and predilections, which also relates back to what Graham was saying this morning about knowing yourself, because there's many different ways to do this, and if you play to your strengths, you're more likely to be effective. So that's GVV in a nutshell. As I said, it's now being used in many, many places. There's a lot of materials available on it. We'll talk more about that tomorrow. but I thank you for letting me give you just a nutshell sort of introduction to it this morning.